For those of you who were here last night, Michael Parenti doesn't really need an introduction. He gave his own. For those of you who haven't heard him yet, I think you'll find him the kind of person that can help us move on from where we are, from that state of sort of scratching our heads and a little bit depressed about how things look out there, to remembering why we need to continue to work. Dr. Parenti has authored a number of books on government in the United States, on imperialism, on the media. Those have been listed in some of the promotional material that we've given to you. They can be ordered through the John Reed Bookstore, which has a table outside. In addition, Dr. Parenti is now making audio and video tapes of many of his lectures. I believe there are about 17 different lectures now on tape. Those are done on a nonprofit basis to try to get out the message. They're not done in order to make royalties for the speaker. So we'd encourage you to use those as organizing tools. They also can be obtained through the John Reed Bookstore. Dr. Parenti?
Well, thank you. It's very nice to be here again. I was reading somewhere that Winston Churchill called World War II the most avoidable war in history. And the reason so is because the Great Britain and France, the Allied powers, did not appease Adolf Hitler, although that's the usual image given today. If we didn't stand up to Hitler, look what happened. So we've got to stand up to Hussein. Otherwise, this worst will happen. That false historical analogy is able to be marketed because people are given so much false history. And in fact, the Allied powers did not appease Hitler. They openly and actively collaborated with Hitler in the taking over of Austria, in the dismantling of Czechoslovakia, even to the point where Chamberlain threatened the Czechs that if they did not accept the Munich Pact, Britain would come down on them. And the Brits froze all Czechoslovak assets that were in England and handed them over to the Germans, because they had a plan. And the plan was to increase and strengthen Hitler's base so that he would attack Soviet Russia. If you recall, just 18 years before, Britain was involved in a war against Soviet Russia. So was France, so was the United States, and about 11 other nations, to stop an alternative social order from developing that might use its land, its minerals, its royalty, its resources in a different way, a way that might develop the country rather than serve for capital accumulation. So they had not given up on that, and they saw Hitler as a bulwark against socialism in Germany, and they saw Nazi Germany as a bulwark against socialism in Europe and a force to roll back socialism in Russia. That dedication to preventing alternative social orders from developing is still the major impetus in U.S. foreign policy. It's no longer Great Britain that plays the global role. It's the United States that has that function. And if World War II were an avoidable war, so was the Gulf War. That war could have been avoided by asking Kuwait to respect the OPEC pricing agreements. Saddam Hussein said that economic aggression was being committed against his country, selling oil cheap to U.S. companies, which doesn't mean that we get it any cheaper. You know, they go out to cheap markets and want cheap resources and cheap labor. It doesn't mean they exert themselves all that way to give you a better break. They pay workers $12 an hour in Ohio, then they export those jobs to Honduras or El Salvador and make energy rods or computers or typewriters or rubber tires or whatever else. They don't bring those tires back and sell them to you at that labor cost that they got. They go down there, the cheaper labor they could pay, the wider is their profits. They still sell them at stateside prices, the highest profit they can get from the market. But Hussein was one of those nationalist leaders, Arab nationalists, who decided that he wanted to do something else than just give away the oil in his country at the cheapest possible price, that he wanted to have some part of it for the development of his own country. The war could have been avoided by making Kuwait stop its slant drilling of the Rumaila oil fields, having raided about $4.5 billion worth of oil, which was coming from the Iraqi reserves. The war could have been avoided if Kuwait had shown any kind of consideration in terms of negotiating a drifting northern border that kept drifting further and further north into Iraq with new installations and settlements. And one could go on. The ground war could have been avoided and peace could have come a week earlier and maybe 30,000 deaths earlier if George Bush had shown any interest in allowing Saddam Hussein to withdraw from Kuwait. Why does Bush act this way? Well, I have a theory. I don't think it's a theory. I don't think it's a Marxist analysis. I don't think it's a left view. I don't think it's a radical or extremist view. I don't think I'm extremist. We're not extremists. The extremists are in power. We're moderates. The extremists are bombing and killing and neglecting human needs and destroying life and destroying our ecology. We're the moderates who want to bring some sanity back into life. They got it all wrong, and the media's got it all wrong. The extremists are the ones who check their brains and jump around like little puppets and mouth whatever it is the White House is saying. That's the media. That's the yellow ribbon binge crowd. But we're the moderates. We want to think rationally and critically, which is what a democratic citizenry should be doing, you see. Well, now let's see what those extremists are up to. All of humanity, ladies and gentlemen, all of humanity is divided into column A and column B. In column A are the people, the select few, who live off the dividends from their stocks, off the interest and earnings from their bonds and securities, off the appreciation from their holdings and speculative investments, off the land, mineral, and oil royalties, and off rents, who live principally off that. Some of them may actually work. David Rockefeller draws a salary from Chase Manhattan Bank, but that hardly explains the immense fortune that he controls. He got rich not by working hard. He got rich the way most people get rich. Not all, but most people get rich and stay rich. Not by working hard, but by getting lots of other people to work hard for you. Which brings us to column B, which I feel is heavily represented in this audience right now today. Kind of a scruffy but lovable lot, I'd say. It's okay. I'd like you to know, I bought this jacket. It's been the cause of some comment. I bought this jacket at a People's Weekly World garage sale for $5 in Washington, D.C. Determined to let you know that some things will never go out of style. Okay. One of them being truth and justice. Column B is made up of the other 97% of mankind, of humankind, I'm sorry, of humanity. Column B is made up of those people who live off wages, salaries, fees, commissions, pensions. And principally, I mean, you might have a little CD and you earn some interest on it and all that sort of thing, but you can't really live off that. George Bush is dedicated to keeping the world safe for the people in column A. George Bush is dedicated to doing that. And to do that, to keep the world safe for your friends and your kind in column A, calling it peace and freedom and Americanism, Bush must defend the class system that so benefits himself and his kind. And he must defend the social order that maintains that class system. And he must defend the state power that maintains that social order. And he must defend the military power that maintains the state power. A military power which indeed becomes coterminous with patriotism in the minds of some poor, distorted, demented people who really think you're a better patriot when you're killing the people of another country. Whereas we know what real patriotism is, and that's to work for peace and prosperity and social justice. Now, George Bush resembles Ronald Reagan and other presidents because he represents the same social formation. When Reagan left the White House, when he was retiring, there was a rather impressive list of multimillionaires and billionaires who all contributed $100,000 each, do you remember that? To buy him a huge estate and mansion that he and Nancy could retire to. It cost millions of dollars. $100,000 each, that's like you kicking in $5 each. Or $3 or $2 as some of you did at the door. Okay. It was their way of saying, thank you, Mr. President. Thank you for the hundreds of billions of dollars in tax cuts. Thank you for destroying the progressive income tax system, which was at a 70% level when you came in and which you've knocked down to 28%. Thank you for shifting hundreds of billions of dollars in taxes from column A to column B. Thank you for vetoing environmental laws that might cut into our profits and not let us pass our diseconomies onto the public. Thank you for the $2.5 trillion in military contracts with 300% cost overruns and record profits. Thank you for cutting human services in the non-profit public sector, because we don't want an expanding non-profit public sector, one that shows that you could answer to some basic human needs and the like, and social needs, because the larger your public sector, the less there is room for private sector. Thank you for rolling back the banking regulations that led to a $1 trillion plunder of the savings and loan industry. Thank you for crushing Little Grenada because it was attempting to expand its public sector and limit the prerogatives of multinational corporations, and Little Grenada that would serve as a bad example to others in the Caribbean and in the Third World. And to George Bush, they say the same. Thank you, Mr. President, for carrying on in the same tradition, for making the world safe for your friends in column A. Now, it's at this point that there's someone who says, oh, what are you, a conspiracy theorist? All the time. See, what are you, a conspiracy theorist? My son has a poster up in his house in the Bay Area. He lives, and it's a cartoon picture. It's of two steer standing in the meadow. And one of them has an anguished look on his face and is saying, oh, I just found out how they make hamburgers. And the other steer is looking sort of a smirk and saying, oh, you leftist paranoiacs with your conspiracy theorists. Just because some people have fantasies about conspiracies doesn't mean that every conspiracy is a fantasy. We know there are very real conspiracies. When people say to you, oh, what do you believe in conspiracies? They say, I don't believe in them. I just see them because they hit me right in the face. Watergate break-in was a conspiracy. And then there was another conspiracy called the Watergate cover-up. Nixon was gotten on the second, not the first. Gotten, I mean, he just had to leave office. Iran-Contra, the investigators of the Iran-Contra themselves said, a conspiracy of such magnitude that we may never get at the bottom of this whole thing, which involved key elements of the national security state itself. We may never get at the bottom. And I sat there, I remember saying, not the way you're investigating it, you never will get at the bottom of it. You see, because the goal of that investigation is to give the appearance of self-cleansing and self-correcting. To give the appearance of self-cleansing and self-correcting, you have to do some of that, and some heads have to roll. But you don't want to go too far into the muck and mire of it, because you are afraid it would destabilize that very system which you're complicit with. And you had members of the committee saying, see, there's the media. When you start gesturing, that's when they take pictures of you. Go ahead. You can stand here and talk for 10 minutes like this. The minute you go like that, pew, 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 they start. What was I saying? You can destabilize, but you don't want to go. You had members of the committee saying, we need a successful presidency. We need a successful administration. We can't keep knocking off presidents. No, that wouldn't be good for the country. I said, no, you need justice. You need to find out what's been happening. And so they engaged in acts of cover-up. The worst act of cover-up of the Iran-Contra hearings, and I said it at that time, the worst act of cover-up was the failure to call to that committee to testify Vice President George Bush. And that's something they never did. We just was witnessing the greatest financial conspiracy in the history of the world. The SNL savings and loan conspiracy, 1,000 conspiracies, at least 1,000 conspiracies of bribery, fraud, and theft. So much so, the Justice Department says we don't have enough lawyers to prosecute this. We don't have enough FBI agents to investigate it. That's right, because FBI agents are out there too busy investigating people who want to save the environment or save El Salvador from destruction or do solidarity work and work for social justice. So they don't have enough of them to investigate the real crooks, the real criminals, the real dangers to our country. Conspiracy, look at the way conspiracy is applied. This whole notion of, oh, what do you have a conspiracy theory? Teachers can organize to advance their interests. Farmers can organize and advance their interests. Machinists can do it. Sanitation workers can do it. But the minute you suggest that the people who own the agribusiness lands, the factories, the banks, the media, the financial structures, the scientific structures, the technology, the capital, and control most of the labor of this society. The minute you suggest that they look out for their interests and pursue their interests and advance their interests and use state power to do that, you're called a conspiracy theorist. You're imagining things because they don't do that, do they? David Rockefeller gets up in the morning and says, what am I going to do today? Oh, I don't know. Will I seek to advance my holdings? Will I answer that White House call? No, that would be conspiracy theory. I'm not going to do that. I don't like unions, though. What about you, Mr. DuPont? You don't like unions, too? Isn't that funny? Why don't you like them? I think I just don't like them. Unions, it sounds like onion, yeah. And it's and I hate onions, you know. And then they'll bring out Scotty Reston, and he'll say... And Scotty Reston will say in the interview, will say, David Rockefeller was a funny guy. He hated onions. A lot of people don't even know this about him. And I think that affected, he confused often that word with unions. And he was a very complex kind of guy. And that's what it was all about, you see. And that kind of blather goes on and on. And if you say they have rational interests and they use power in rational and ruthless ways, oh, you must be a conspiracy theorist. That the media is controlled by certain people who have a certain ideological and class perspective, and they systematically eliminate the perspective that I am now speaking about. They don't even rebut it or allow it to be debated on a regular basis. They simply eliminate it. Oh, you must be a conspiracy theorist. Well, the next time they say that to you, you have to say, no, I'm a reality theorist. The alternative is, of course, this coincidence theory, that these things just keep happening by coincidence. Or it's a somnambulist theory, the day Rockefeller gets up and just walks around like that. There are four possible systems that might arise in the Middle East. There's a revolutionary socialist movement. And there have been strong revolutionary socialist movements in Dhofar, which was crushed by the Shah's mercenary armies and the CIA. South Yemen actually had a Marxist revolution, which took over South Yemen after the British colonialists, even kicked out the British colonialists. The Polisario regime movement in Western Sahara has a strong revolutionary socialist strain in it. The second kind of system is the Arab nationalist, whose leaders are not socialist. In fact, they're even sometimes capitalist. They want to use private capital, but on their own terms, often in conjunction with state enterprises. They're militaristic. They may even suppress their communist parties, as Saddam Hussein did, but they also have a populist strain or element in them. They want to use the resources of their country for national development. Gaddafi, for instance, might serve as that. there's a the third system is an Islamic fundamentalist. The Islamic fundamentalist often devolves into obscurantist modes and as a reactive, repressive religiosity, and much of that really has its roots, though, in anti-imperialism. That is, they are so appalled by what imperialism has done to their country, but they identify that imperialism not in its political economy, but in its secularity and the Western movies and the nudity and this sort of thing. And so they want to drive out the Western devil. So to that extent, they're sometimes anti-Western, and they too may sometimes have a populist element there. So even the Ayatollah Khomeini had a few social programs for the poor and some little bits which they didn't normally get. Now, the U.S. opposes all three of these types in the same declining order of great, that I've given them to you. It hates the first one the most, the revolutionary socialist. It hates the Arab nationalist the second, and the Islamic fundamentalists the third, maybe the ones they could most likely live with of those three if they had to. If all three had something in common, it is that they are nationalists and they try to leave something for their own people. If all three have something in common, it is that they're not the fourth type, which is the type that U.S. leaders like George Bush really like. And that fourth type is what we call the client state. By the client state, we mean it's ruled by a comprador class. A comprador class is a class that opens up its country, its labor, its markets, its national resources, completely to the multinationals. And he says, come on in here, it's yours, take it, whatever you want, cheap labor, cheap markets, cheap resources, here's the oil, here's the tin, here's the copper, here's the cocoa, here's the manganese, here's the bauxite, here's everything, it's yours, just make sure you take care of me and my family, and my brother-in-laws, and my cousins, and all that, and if our workers get out of line, you'll come in and equip our police, our security force, to beat them, torture them, and disappear them, and death squad them. That is making the world safe for the multinational corporations and for Western capitalism. That's what the Saudi family does, or the Sabah family in Kuwait. That's what King Farouk did in Egypt. That's what the Shah did in Iran. The Saudi and Sabah families have about $1 trillion invested in the United States in treasury bonds, in real estate, in deposits in Chase Manhattan Bank and Morgan Guaranty Trust, and in the corporations, in stock ownership of corporations. So they take that money and they don't waste it on frivolous things like hospitals and clinics and schools and that stuff. For the most part, they take it and they put it where Western finance capitalism wants them to put it. That history is not ever mentioned in the media. That frame of political economic exploitation and community of interest is not mentioned. We're told that the King Fahd of Saudi Arabia is our friend and is friendly to the United States. Now, he's an autocrat. He's a butcher. What then is the community of interest between something like King Fahd and U.S. interests? It is in U.S. interest to support him. What's the community interest between a Somoza, a butcher in Nicaragua, and the United States? What was the community of interest between a Batista of Cuba and the U.S. that they were so friendly with them? Or with any number of other dictators, or with any number of phony presidents who were elected by showcase elections? What is the community of interest? It is that they are keeping that part of the world safe for the interest of the people in column A. In 1953, the CIA engineered a bloody coup in Iran against Mohammad Mossadegh. Mohammad Mossadegh, a popular leader, had nationalized the oil holdings of the giant international oil cartels. He therefore was a dangerous man. I remember I was a junior in college in 1953, and I didn't pay that much attention, but I remember the impression I had from the media of Mohammad Mossadegh. I wasn't very political either at that time. My impression was he was a madman. And you watch Anytime this U.S. White House CIA media starts targeting somebody and calling him a madman, a drug dealer, a Hitler, a this or that, you watch, it's because he's making things uncomfortable for column A and there's going to be some action. They're getting you ready to target him and getting you scared and let you know that this Mohammed Mossadegh or this Noriega, or these Sandinistas, or this Castro, or this Gaddafi, or this Saddam Hussein is a danger, a mortal danger to us. Going to get your mama. You got to watch out. We got to get rid of him. Kill him. I mean, it is rather amazing, you know. About four years ago, when Reagan was targeting Gaddafi, I was going around the country and I heard people Gaddafiing all over the place. I mean, there were some people who had been convinced that this leader of a nation of 3 million was a mortal threat to the survival and security of the United States. And I used to say, and when the media gets tired of Gaddafi or when the target is something else, is he going to be any less a danger? But you're not going to go to bed and have nightmares about him anymore because you don't, that thing isn't hyping you in the media. This is the kind of thing we have to be fighting. Well, a coup was perpetrated against Mohammed Mossadegh. He was overthrown. And the hated Shah of Iran was put in with his Savak secret police. That was a CIA-engineered coup. And the man who helped train those Savak secret police and torturers was Norman Schwarzkopf's father. It's all in the family. The man who headed the whole CIA operation was CIA operative intelligence officer Kermit Roosevelt. And Kermit Roosevelt was rewarded with a 7-figure bonus and a vice presidency in Gulf Oil Company not long afterwards. And at that time, the New York Times lectured, quote, underdeveloped countries with rich resources now have an object lesson in the heavy cost that must be paid when one of their number that goes berserk with fanatical nationalism. Fanatical nationalism meaning not a client state, empty trappings, but one that actually wants to get hold of the destiny of its own country. The CIA set up internal security networks and secret police in Iran, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and a number of other countries in the region that tortured and murdered tens of thousands of the regime's opponents. In 1955, when the oil workers of Saudi Arabia went on strike, the secret security police and army rounded them up and chopped their hands off. It tracked down and murdered exiled opponents of the Saudi monarchy and of King Hassan in Morocco. The CIA tried to assassinate Egypt's President Nasser. Now, Nasser took over in a colonel's rebellion in Egypt, and one of the first things he did was to nationalize the Suez Canal, to take it out of the hands of Great Britain, of the British and French cartels that controlled it. And then he took the earnings from the Suez Canal traffic and started using them for things like health clinics and mass public education, which the Egyptian masses got for the first time in their history. It was then that Secretary of State John Forster Dulles, a former oil company lawyer, a former sugar company lawyer, brother of Alan Dulles, who was head of the CIA, it was then that John Forster Dulles, Secretary of State, called Nasser, quote, ready for the quote? You know what it is. He called him Hitler of the Nile. In U.S. Marines occupied Lebanon to protect an unpopular French-installed regime in 1958. Dwight Eisenhower sent the Marines in. The United States armed Morocco to attack nationalist Algeria in 1962. In 1963, the CIA helped overthrow the nationalist government in Iraq and murder thousands of its supporters. From 1962 to 1967, the United States, Britain, and Saudi Arabia armed and financed a royalist insurrection against the Yemen Arab Republic, in which 250,000 people were killed or died in fighting. The CIA organized a right-wing mercenary army to invade socialist South Yemen, one that got its ass kicked real good. They don't win everything they do. And now, as I say, it's not that these governments are led by madmen or that they're even all that revolutionary, but it is that they are taking some portion of those earnings for the development of their own countries. And it's not that the heads of the corporations want to see these people poor or not have books to read or anything. If you ask them, they say, oh, heck, we want that for them. Generally, they don't care one way or the other what the condition of the people are in a country that they invest in. They care about how safe the investment will be and how lucrative it will be. They put money into the country not to uplift it, but to take out more than they put in. They will tell you otherwise. They will say, well, we're helping them, we're in there, we're creating jobs for them, we're doing all this. If that's true, how is it that in the last 40 years, while investments from Europe, North America, and Japan have increased tremendously in the third world, so has poverty, malnutrition, and all the other desperate and economic and environmental devastation also increased? If those investments really do uplift the people, why are the conditions of their lives getting worse and worse? The point is, any dollar that goes to these nationalists is $1 less that's going to come to us in profits. And so they've got to be stopped for that. Saddam Hussein doesn't take the hundreds of millions of dollars or the billions that he's earning from oil. He doesn't take them and deposit them in Chase Manhattan and Morgan Guaranty Trust or in Treasury bonds. This is why we're ready to restore the Sabah family, as have done in Kuwait. What was the first political act of the Sabah family in a free Kuwait? I see these cars go by with bumper stickers that says, free Kuwait. I say, what are you talking about, free Kuwait? It's like saying, free Germany, give it back to Hitler, you know? What was the first act? The first act was to declare martial law. Martial law is ruled by bayonet. It's the suspension of all civil liberties. So this is what we fought for, to make that country safe for martial law. What's the second thing that was done? Second thing was Secretary Baker went to see the Emir of Kuwait in Saudi Arabia, where he's off in some posh watering luxury hole, you know, with his Rolls Royces and his every other conceivable luxury you can think of. And he's saying, hey, you know, this doesn't look so good. I mean, you know, your country's bleeding star. We just liberated it, and you're sitting here. You got to get back there. I mean, if I was the Emir of Kuwait, I would have said to him, Mr. Secretary, you fought so well and hard to defend my way of life and my style of life, so let me live it, will you? Let me enjoy it. And the Emir of Kuwait, in fact, he did say he would go back when security conditions and comfort and accommodations were ready. Well, Baker leaned on him a little, and as you know, he went back this week, didn't he? To millions of Kuwaitis in the streets cheering him, right? No, wrong. There was nobody out there. Even the media was forced to note that it was a notable indifference or dispirited response to the Emir of Kuwait as he came back in his Rolls Royce or little stretch limousine, whatever he had, and was looking and waving at the lampposts. Bush did not only want to free Kuwait, but destroy Iraq. Its bridges were bombed. Its universities have been bombed. Its scientific research centers were bombed terribly and horribly under the guise that they were all little hotbeds for nuclear weapons and chemical warfare. Its water treatment facilities were bombed. Its infrastructure, its sewage systems, all this, which is causing cholera and typhoid now. When you bomb the water facility of a civilian population in a city like Baghdad, you are committing an act of terrorism. And that's what we call it. Bush was guilty of terrorism. So Saddam Hussein may still rule, but he rules a rubble. And that's the message that's given. That was Nixon's message in Indochina when he carpet-bombed Cambodia and Laos as the Cambodian liberation forces moved along. Every village that was liberated was then carpet-bombed by U.S. bombers. I mean, it was a savage, horrible story, which still isn't told. A lot of people, even the peace movement, don't know it. The message is either we rule or we ruin. You want to take it, we'll let you take it. You want to hold on it, we'll let you hold on it. But what you're going to hold on to is a devastated shell. These facts about what U.S. power does in the world are systematically suppressed in the U.S. media and in the national dialogue. They're kept from millions of people, from the mass of people. Most of those people who are waving that flag have no idea and couldn't believe it and never heard it. And so we've got to point that out and realize that that's some of the message we've got to get to them. A suppressed dialogue is not a democratic dialogue. This war is teaching the people of our country the wrong lessons. First of all, it wasn't a war, it was a one-sided slaughter. But the message is, if you can win it easily, then fight it. The message is to uncritically accept the programming and the PR hype and campaign that comes from the White House and the mainstream media about the demonization of this or that leader. Once you demonize a leader, the leader is then treated as identical with the country, and it's an easy thing then to take out the whole country in a kind of a Super Bowl thing. The message was to have faith in the wonders and glories of our high-tech instruments of death. A nation that cuts back on its education funding, that can't feed all of its own children or house the homeless, that can't develop a rational, energy-efficient transportation system that gives us missiles, but it can give us missiles that fly and correct themselves and kill people, multi-million-dollar computers on board those missiles. This war was a big promo for the military-industrial complex. General Schwarzkopf standing there congratulating, telling you how brilliant he was. He said, "We did a northern flank and came around. We faked them out. All their forces were down here in the southeast and the coast. We concentrated some deployment, but we came right around here and we got them." And it was like brilliant. Oh, yeah, not since Waterloo have we seen such genius, you know. I mean, and I'm sitting there saying, what is he talking about? I knew they were going to do that the first time I saw the map. He said, well, this is wide open. They're going to go right up, walk right up into Saudi Arabia and flank them out. And the Iraqis knew that. The Iraqis knew it. The thing is, they couldn't respond to it because their forces were totally pinned down and immobilized. When you move, you have to mobilize and you have to concentrate your forces. And then, of course, they'd just be bombed more. As happened when they finally did mobilize and try to withdraw and get out of the country, they were slaughtered. I mean, this kind of slaughter was celebrated as an act of heroism. And this is, of course, what dismays and disheartens many of us. And that's okay. Feel dismayed and feel disheartened. Feel disgusted. Feel demoralized. Feel a little defeated. And then get right back up and fight the next round. Because we... What you have to have is what the great Italian communist Antonio Gramsci called a pessimism of the mind and an optimism of the will. You have a pessimism of the mind, you see how bad things are, that's part of your of arming yourself, that's part of your weaponry, but you have an optimism of the will and you keep struggling and keep struggling and things will move in our direction. George Bush calls it a can-do nation. We're doing, you know, these things resemble what happened in Vietnam, and that resembles what happened years before in other wars, and that resembles what happened. I'm doing a study now of the war of 1898, how the U.S. got into the Spanish-American War, because I believe history is one of the weapons, and they when they keep history from you, they're keeping vital information from us and a vital perspective from us. And it's amazing how these patterns resemble each other. And I remember George Santayana's often quoted, reverently quoted statement that those who don't learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat them. I don't believe it. I don't believe that at all. I know it's quoted all the time as the last word in history. Everybody goes, yeah, isn't that true? I don't believe it in terms of our leaders. If they repeat these actions again and again, it's not because they haven't learned from history. It's because they've learned those lessons all too well. They learn what works. If the imperialists of today use the same kind of lies and machinations and violence and murder as the imperialists of yesterday, it's because they're advancing the same kinds of interests. They're repressing and destroying the same kinds of masses of people who are trying to fight for better life, and that's why they resemble each other. And it's like Rome of ancient times, though. You know, there are a number of empires that were at the height of their military power when they were on the eve of their decay. And Rome of ancient times was there just that. The center was bled to fortify an ever-expanding periphery. The plebeians were suffering and constricted all the more so that the patricians could pursue their far-off plunder. And today we have the same thing. A party for Caesar, a party for Pompey. But where is the party of the people? Supposedly, the total victory over Iraq has demonstrated that the peace activists were wrong and the president was right. If might makes right, that if a war can be successfully prosecuted, then it proves it was justified. What kind of a logic is that? Hitler took Poland in 2 weeks. Does that mean it's justified? We can say, oh, that was a real good, successful policy. Therefore, Hitler's critics were proven wrong. The war had an immoral disproportionality to it. Even if Saddam Hussein should have been gotten out of Kuwait, it was an immoral disproportionality. Look, I hate the Guatemalan government and I hate the Salvadoran government. They have killed 60, 70, 80,000 of their own people, each of them respectively. I think Guatemala is higher than Salvador. But that doesn't mean I would support the carpet bombing of Guatemala City or San Salvador and kill other tens of thousands of people to get rid of that regime. You have to have some disproportion. What I would do is cut off aid, cut off weapons, cut off guns to their military and aid the revolutionary popular democratic forces that want a different life. Well, it was partly a mistake of some peace advocates who framed their opposition in the minimalist opportunist terms, which is, we must always appeal only to American self-interest, that if you dare to ask an American to be concerned about the life of someone else, we might lose our political influence. So let's emphasize the body bags. Let's emphasize how costly this war will be. Well, you play right into their hands, because if they can have a war that isn't costly, as demonstrated with Grenada and Panama, then you have no argument. That same kind of argument was often used about nuclear war. I remember I.F. Stone using it. I said, Izzy, what the hell? Why are you saying that? He got up once, it was in Georgetown, and he said, both sides will be destroyed in a nuclear war. Both sides. It is crazy, both sides. Well, maybe you have to emphasize that irrational, totalistic quality of nuclear weaponry. You have to say that. But there's something immoral in that. You also then have to say, and if only one side were destroyed, that too would be too horrible to contemplate, that we could successfully incinerate 1/8 of the Earth's surface. And in fact, you would incinerate most of your own ecology and your own ozone layer, whatever else, doing that. The implication being that it's okay to kill masses of people. Well, most of us in this peace movement didn't make that mistake. Most of us haven't, and we're not going to, and we're going to continue. We oppose these kinds of wars and these interventions, not because it would be costly to both sides, but because it would kill human lives. We don't care what lives, if they're American, Iraqi, Palestinian, Israeli, Jordanian, Guatemalan. We don't want them killed. We don't want them killed if they're civilians and women and children. We don't want them killed if they're men in uniform either. We don't want anybody killed. We're sick of that kind of stuff. A war that's fought and prosecuted. A war that's fought and prosecuted for no other reason than to defend the profits and investments of the giant corporate oil cartels. We won't support that. We'll continue to oppose it. A war that's fought to prevent alternative uses of the resources of the third world and self-determination and self-development. A war that's a hype for the military-industrial complex. A war that does nothing but advance the political fortunes of that preppy snot in the White House. That's not our war. Don't tell me we're weak. We're not weak. We organize and we mobilize and we keep organizing and our numbers will grow. Don't listen to those polls. History was never made by a public opinion poll. History was made by determined, organized people, often numerical minorities, who fought and got things on the agenda. Industrial workers in Flint, Michigan, in Ludlow, in working communities throughout this country for decades, even to this day, they didn't stop to take a poll. If they had taken a poll in 1934, they would have found most middle-class Americans would have associated unions with syndicalists and anarchists and communists and wouldn't have liked it. But they built their unions, they seized those factories, they developed, they fought back, and they were a minority, and they made history. The women of this country didn't take a poll, the activist women, and it wasn't women as a mass rising up when the feminist movement developed. They were hit with slander and calumny and stereotypes, bunch of bra-burning creeps and are they real women or what, this and that. They didn't listen to that, and including many women who said things like that at them. And I remember just 30 years ago when abortion was a criminal word. I mean, nobody talked about it. There wasn't anything in the media reference or anything. It was a criminal act. And we're fighting and we've legalized and we have legal safe abortion and we've got to keep fighting to protect that. But they were a minority who started. They had less than 9%. And African-American people who started, those kids who went into those first drugstores and sat there in the segregated counters, they didn't take an opinion poll of America to find out how do you feel about desegregating counters. They went against that and fought that thing. And how long you think you can keep distracting people with circuses, with bloody circuses? After a while, you know, the people start floating off, drifting off into reality again. They start thinking about really weirdo things like jobs and paying rent, and they wonder, what has George Bush really done for me? That process is already happening in England. The Brits are usually ahead of us on class awareness, you know. But you have watched the BBC coverage of this war? The BBC coverage, if you watched it there, you would come away with a very clear distinction that this war was being fought by Great Britain. They'd have Prime Minister John Major in front of number 10 Downing Street with some assistance from lesser forces like the French and the Americans and these others. And Major would stand there and say, the Royal Air Force forces have struck and delivered so many sorties, and our forces, the 15th Scottish Regiment, has moved into place. And the President called me last night from the White House to ask about developments on this. And the more he did that, his popularity poll was going up and up and up. And the more he saw the popularity poll going up, the more he got up there in front of number 10 Downing, you know, the next day had a helmet on his head and a machine gun. Not really, but. Well, a funny thing happened on the way to the elections just last week. The Conservatives, one of the safest seats in Parliament in Ribble Valley, northwest England, a seat that they win by 75%, 80%, they lost the seat. It was a very conservative, they're very conservative. They wouldn't vote for Labour, but they voted for the Liberal Party. The Liberals beat the Conservatives. And the Washington Post, March 9th, says, voters in northwest England's Ribble Valley delivered a rude reminder that Britain's supporting role in winning the war is far less important to them than pocketbook issues back home. Mostly that poll tax is what everybody's furious about. The new prime minister was enjoying some of the highest popularity ratings in modern times, but Tories are worried about the next election. So don't give up on our people. They can be fooled again and again, but we do have issues that have some real strength behind them. We have the ecology issue, peace, health, education. Remember, those same people waving those flags also give tremendous popularity ratings to presidents when they sign peace and détente treaties with the Soviet Union, or when Nixon went to China. That saved him for re-election and opening up and calling for peace. The people supported that too. But we have the fight for education, for tax reform that taxes the rich, for job programs, for rational energy policy. Again, let me repeat, ecology and environment, which will be the issue, only because it's going to become impossible to ignore it as things go on, for massive cuts in the bloated military budget, for democratization and pluralization of the media's news and commentary, for an end to global militarism, for an end to the freedom to deliver death and destruction upon other peoples because your leaders tell you that their leaders aren't nice, for support for the democratic forces in Latin America, Asia, Africa, and the Middle East, All of this, brothers and sisters, is not just a good idea. It is a raging necessity. It is the struggle for democracy itself, for the Earth's future. A friend of mine told me once the story. He went to a Chinese acupuncturist because he was having a pain in his neck. And the acupuncturist put a needle in his arm and a couple of them in his leg. And he says, "Hey, wait a minute, what's the connection here? I got this pain in my neck and you're putting a needle in my arm, my leg." And the Chinese acupuncturist said to him, "Whole body connected, take a look." You know, which I think is sort of nice, is that kind of Chinese gentle contempt for the idiot Westerner. So we want to say to those jerks in the White House, whole universe, whole Earth is connected, take a look. The devastation you've affected on this environment is going to, and through these wars, are going to affect generations on, and we have got to stop you. Let me end with a selection from, or a parable from Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the great French philosopher. In the 1750 or so, he wrote, it was the dissertation on the origins of inequality. 250 years later, still very pertinent. And he has a little historical parable in there. He doesn't think this actually happened in history, but he uses it as a parable. He says, all of our problems began when that first man dug a moat and put down stakes. And he said, you can come in here. This is now mine. And I'll let you in to work this land, and I'll take the fruits of your labor, and you may gather from the trees, but and you'll get a little sustenance to sustain yourself, but it'll all be from me, and then I'll put down more stakes and more moats, and I'll live better and better and better off your labor. And Rousseau says, how many lies, how much treachery, how much hypocrisy, how much deceit, how many wars, how much murder could have been prevented if those people had pulled up those stakes, filled in the moat, and they had said to that man, away with you, away, because the fruits of the earth belong to everyone. And the earth itself, the beautiful earth, belongs to no one. Thank you.
Minutes left. If any of you want to serve us up some questions here, Mr. Prendy will field them.
Yes. Now I'm pointing to this woman.
More information about Schwarzkopf's father?
I don't have any more information about Schwarzkopf's father other than he worked with the Shah in developing the Sabak secret police, but I think he was with the, I don't know if he was with Army Intelligence or with CIA. I don't know. Yes, sir.
How can we get rid of the CIA?
What?
How can we get rid of the CIA?
Well, you know, Daniel Patrick Moynihan just put a proposal in Congress to abolish the CIA. And we should start making that part of our agenda. Abolish the CIA and call for its elimination. You can have intelligence, you know, gathering, but the CIA is involved in more than just intelligence for security and defense purposes. It's involved in murderous covert actions. It would be only a symbolic campaign. It's like Henry Gonzalez, Congressperson Gonzalez's resolution, House Resolution 34, which is to impeach George Bush. Support that. Now, Bush is politically untouchable right now, but there's a, you know, symbolic moves have a way of gathering substance, and they, even if it remains only symbolic, it has an impact. It is saying that this guy was operating in violation of the Constitution, which he was. He announced that no matter how Congress voted on this issue, he was going to go for the war. He was letting you know that the executive, the state, was much more powerful than the government. If you make that distinction between state and government. I don't know. Yes, Ms.
Why does Congress play along with him so much?
Congress plays along because the executive has controls the high ground. It controls most of the resources. It has the power to execute. It controls the media. I mean, how often does the media rush over to Capitol Hill to hold press conferences for this or that senator? But they're always there for the president. And these Congress people, well, some of them ideologically just share that view, that same kind of view. They're from the same class. More than one-third of the Senate is made up of multimillionaires, so they're not going to be too unfriendly. And they also buy into the rest of the mythology. Others are afraid of those 20-second sound bites that might come up in their districts later on, that Congressman so-and-so did not support our boys in Saudi Arabia or something like that. So that's what happens with them, I guess. How about we do this? 1, 2. Okay, I think your hands were up. Yes, sir.
You covered everything very convincingly. The one thing I'd like to know, if you have any suggestions, any way of getting President Bush away from in front of these television cameras.
Suggestions to get President Bush in any way?
Away from the television cameras.
Away from the television cameras.
If I look for a commercial, it's all I get is Bush every day.
That's probably the most dangerous area in America, that space between George Bush and a television camera. You get in the way, you get be pushed away. What we have to do is keep strengthening the alternative media, you know, things like Station KBOO here in Portland. We have to read publications like The Guardian and People's Weekly World and The Nation and In These Times, even though Jim Weinstein was so nasty to me a few weeks ago. Stupid. But not one of these publications would I say I agree with every single word in it, but they all will give us alternative perspectives. And we have to just keep organizing and keep struggling and know it's a long haul and realize that there are not just instrumental benefits in that long haul, but there are immediate benefits of working with other good, concerned, intelligent, fine people, of whom I've met a number here right in Portland. It adds a whole other dimension to your life to be politically engaged. To not be politically engaged, to live a life that's purely privatized while these things happen to you. First of all, you never purely privatize because you never protect yourself from the awful effects of it. Not in the air you breathe, the food you eat, the taxes you pay. You're involved in it all the time. You go into your house and flick on your light, you're involved in the political processes. Who's making money off your labor that you're going to have to pay, use to pay that bill. So we have to keep active, organize, pace ourselves, not get disheartened, and keep fighting. Yeah.
In a
I'm sorry. It was the gentleman. His hand was up ahead of you. That's all.
Do you believe that the next
stand up and speak aloud? I can't hear.
Do you believe that the next Hitler will be Fidel Castro or something closer to home?
These are the prophecy questions. You know? Well, the question was, do I believe that the next hit will be Fidel Castro? The Cubans believe it. I was just talking to some of them at the Cuban Interest Section in Washington, D.C., and they talked to the first secretary of the Cuban embassy, and he said, it's not embassy, it's Interest Section, because we don't have relations. He said, we feel we're at the top of the list. We're next. And that was before. And they're developing a pattern on how you can do it. They may not have to land a single troop into Cuba. If they could justify bombing Cuba back into the Stone Age, just bombing and destroying Havana, that may not sit well, by the way, with the Cuban right-wing fascist emigres in Miami who still have relatives in Havana, might get a little concerned. It's not as anonymous a thing as Baghdad, you know. But they could start bombing, harassing. They also have a base in Cuba, the Guantanamo base, which they'll never give up. And they're moving in. You could hear Bush saying, until there already was a PBS special, 1 hour special on Fidel Castro, the drug dealer. They're doing the same thing on him as they did on Noriega. The irony of it, Fidel Castro is the only one who actually executed two of his generals for dealing in drugs, whereas the generals of Guatemala, El Salvador are in drugs. I mean, I've read that in the mainstream media. Little, you know, you got to go to page 25 and you find out that the military in these countries is dealing with drugs. Ramon Rodriguez was before the Kerry Committee and they said, what are you doing now? He said, 20 years in jail for drug dealing. Who did you deal with? He said, with the executive and military leaders of Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, Costa Rica, Peru, Colombia. He went on down. And Fidel was the only one who got his guy out. But they're nailing him as the drug dealer. And Ramon Rodriguez, by the way, was a close friend of Felix Rodriguez, who was a close friend of George Bush's. And you want to see the whole CIA, Contra, drugs, guns connection, there it is. But that's what they'll start doing. They could target him, and Bush will get up and say, this drug problem, this unprincipled drug dealing that Fidel Castro has pushed and allowed for years, he has to bring democracy. When he brings democratic elections in his country, then we know that some changes have happened. Bush is now there, and he's trying to say, you set our standards and our conditions, and we'll keep escalating those conditions. When you agree to this condition, we'll say, that's not enough, that's really just a shell, that's a hoax, and you keep doing that. That's the thing they do, and the media will uncritically report that, of course, that way. So we're facing a very dangerous and difficult time. The two things we thought that might deter U.S. power, which was the reaction of the Soviet Union and American political reaction here, both seem to have been eliminated in the Iraqi war. In the case of Cuba, the Soviets might still react, and so might the rest of the world. Well, the U.N. reacted to the invasion of Panama. What did the media do? Never mentioned the U.N. The vote was 72 to 25, against the U.S. invasion in Panama in the General Assembly. Was that gotten around with as much discussion about the U.N. mandate and whatever, the lack of a U.N. mandate? The U.N. only comes in when it can serve as a tool for U.S. imperialism. So these are some of the things we have to keep in mind. And rather than waiting until it happens and say, stop the killing, we've got to start now and say, stop this kind of militaristic interventionism. A poll taken, I guess I said that last night, a poll taken recently showed that most people are less desirous or do not want to support another one of these ventures. They're not really that clear that this really supports their interests. So this is what we have to do. I want to take one last question. It must come from a woman. This is my affirmative action policy. Right here? Okay. Are you right at the microphone? You did it the right way.
I wanted to thank you very much for coming to Portland, and you maybe probably know that the state of Oregon, the highest percentage of voters voted for Reverend Jesse Jackson, to the extent that that's an example of our long, sometimes progressive history. If and when you get tired of bumping around Washington, D.C., you know you'd be more than welcome here. Doing this for 5-10 years.
And no, I think we'd all get tired.
No,
that's funny, because just about 4 months ago I was thinking of moving to Portland, but then I decided against it.
So what can you do? I'm not governor?
No, I think I decided I had to stay in Washington to keep a close watch on George Bush. Do you have a question? Or a
yeah,
I don't mind being stroked. We can stand here.
You're a writer, I take it, and where can we meet you?
Pardon me?
You write for publication?
You can reach me in Washington, D.C. I'm in information, 202-555-1212. Okay? And you can call me then. I have very little time to chit-chat and discuss individual ideas, but if it's something involving political work, you can...
If we wanted to buy a magazine or a newspaper or something that might have your ongoing critique
We have the audio and videotapes. People's Video from Seattle distributes them all over the country. We've sold over 1,000 in the last month. As was pointed out, we don't make a penny on it. All our labor is donated. It's political work. And my books will be available at the John Reed Bookstore. And I do write for periodicals occasionally. I have an article coming out on the Gulf War in Covert Action Information Bulletin, this issue that's coming out now. But it was written so long ago that the issue comes out only, I think, twice a year or once every 4 months, that it's basic. It has a basic summation. It criticizes all the reasons Bush gave for going in and then argued what the real reasons were. But I have no column or particular publication that I work in. But thank you for your interest, and thank you all, and keep going. Thank you.